Welcome to MBA Podcaster, the only source for cutting-edge information and advice on the MBA application process. I'm Janet Nakano. Getting your MBA costs time and money. You want to make sure your return on investment makes sense and that you'll make back your investment in a reasonable amount of time. Join us as we show you how to calculate your return on investment, or ROI, why it's an important figure for comparing schools, whether, quote, average schools are worth the investment, and what are the qualitative factors that contribute to an ROI analysis. To answer these questions, we'll talk to two economic professors who conducted an in-depth study on the ROI of the MBA, and we'll also speak to an MBA admissions consultant. You're debating whether you should spend tens of thousands of dollars and forego two or more years of salary to pursue an MBA. One way to decide is to conduct an economic analysis. Let's calculate what your return on investment will be if you expend all that money. Anthony Davies is an assistant professor of economics at Duquesne University, and Thomas Klein is an associate professor at St. Vincent's College. Together, they co-wrote the ROI on the MBA, featured in BizEd's January-February 2005 issue. They recommend you evaluate your MBA investment by looking at three independent measures. Davies says start with the internal rate of return.
If I look at the tuition I'm paying for the MBA as an investment and the extra money I'm earning over the course of my career is return on that investment, what's the effective interest rate I'm getting? And that's the internal rate of return. You know, what we found is that the internal rate of return, you know, on average using figures 93 through 2001, is on a par with what you'd expect from the NASDAQ, better than what you'd expect from the Dow Jones Industrial Average, hovering around 18%. So that is, in layman's terms, for every buck put into tuition for an MBA degree, you can expect that to come dressed up back as a buck 18.
Davies says you should also look at the net present value of your investment.
So with net present value, what we're doing is answering the question, if you take into account all the money I got to shell out to get the degree, and then you would take into account all the expected return I can get over my lifetime, what's the net equivalent of that in today's terms? Or in other words, if I were to cut you a check right now, free and for nothing, in exchange for you not pursuing the MBA, how large would that check have to be so that you're just as well off with the check as you would have been with the MBA? And that's an easy way of describing net present value. And what we found is that the net present value is significant, over north of $500,000.
You also have to consider your break-even point. How long will it take until your initial investment is paid off? Your total should include tuition and also money lost for time you take off from work. Davies says the average payback period is about 9 years, down 1 year from what it was 15 years ago. Although tuition is increasing, he says starting salaries are also increasing. And even in the first few years after graduation, you should see significant benefits.
The AACSB figures were ballpark 50,000 salary pre-MBA and ballpark 75,000 post. What's also significant is the growth rate. Growth rate of salaries for people who hold professional degrees is about 2% better than inflation, whereas the growth rate of salaries of people who hold only bachelor's degrees are about 1% greater than inflation. And that 1% difference may not sound like a lot, but over the course of a 30, 40-year career, it can actually end up doubling in real terms the initial earnings gap. You can tack on to all of this the fact that employer-paid benefits generally are proportional to salary. So if you're talking about a 20%, 40% difference in salary out of the gate, you can tack on perhaps another 20 to 40% on top of that for employer-paid benefits. So the story just keeps getting better and better in favor of the MBA.
School rankings can be another consideration when calculating your ROI. Toby Hammerling is an admissions consultant with Dream MBA.
In general, I would say that top-rated MBA programs all deserve their rating. They're the best of the best, and almost without exception, they will provide the greatest potential to maximize the future earning power of somebody who graduates from that program. Even with the high cost of tuition, I would say that as long as the MBA salaries keep pace with the rising cost of tuition, than MBA programs in general, but especially the top-rated schools, will offer a very strong return on investment. And especially this last year, we've seen some very encouraging numbers in that regard.
As Hammerling says, top 20 schools will typically earn a better ROI, but top 50 schools can be just as competitive, says Anthony Davies. The less established schools, Davies says, are the ones that may not add as much economic value.
One of the things that's happened over the past 20 or 30 years has been this proliferation of quote-unquote MBA programs, where every four-year institution now is offering one. Non-AACSB accredited MBA programs can be, I won't say they all are, but they can be little more than undergraduate refresher courses.
But can you still get a decent ROI if you attend a program that's not ranked in the top 20 or 50? Hammerling says you can.
I would say that the MBA still adds a significant amount of value over any undergraduate education because the MBA program really has the ability to dig down a lot deeper and get a lot more in detail than any undergrad education.
Stay tuned at the end of this show to hear an interview with Veritas Prep, a GMAT preparatory provider. You'll hear their recommendations for acing the GMAT. Veritas is also offering a special $150 discount on their test prep services to MBA podcaster listeners by using the code POD150 when registering for classes. Toby Hammerling says while the ROI is important, it shouldn't be the sole determining factor in deciding which schools to apply or what offer of admission to accept.
Straightforward return on investment analysis will, of course, be able to quantify things like the cost of tuition, any scholarships or financial incentives offered, each school's post-graduation starting salary, the expected time to placement, as well as the future earning potential of graduates. However, the problem with this analysis, in my opinion, is that it does not consider any of the qualitative factors that should play an important role in deciding on which program to attend. The qualitative factors that, in my opinion, are the most important are the program size, is it a large or a small class, the fit with the student culture of the applicant, such as is the student culture more competitive or collaborative, how diverse is the class, and then also the specialization of the school in terms of whether their curriculum is more focused on international business, finance, consulting. And then lastly, I would say that the location of the school can also play a big role, whether it's in a big or a small city, whether it's inside the U.S. or not, and even East Coast versus West Coast schools, there can be a big difference there. I think in general, I would say that it's very important for students to look at each school individually and to think about only themselves when they're calculating the return on investment. This is, to me, a very personal decision because I think that one school may provide a great return for one student because it provides what he or she is looking for, but may provide a much lesser return for another student who is looking for something slightly different. So my advice to students would be to really do the analysis for themselves rather than go by either the rankings or by what school their friends are attending. This is something that's going to have a major impact on the rest of their life, and they owe it to themselves to analyze this decision very carefully.
Thomas Klein is co-author of The ROI of the MBA. He says the qualitative factors to consider will depend on the person.
For example, the undergraduate discipline. If you take an engineering degree holder and you couple that with a decent MBA, historically they're going to produce relatively high earnings potentials because they have this technical background and now they've learned some of the important business acumen, management and leadership and accounting and finance and so forth that they didn't get as an engineer. So that's quite powerful. However, if you take a philosophy major or a business major who's seeking an MBA, they might not get as much in the marketplace. There's not as much to gain there. Secondly, I think if you're a career changer, you should expect to gain relatively less than those who are already building their credentials. For example, let's take a marketing associate who gets an MBA from one of these solid schools that's not in the top 50, and she seeks a brand management position. She should be seeking a higher paying offers because she's building, she's within field. But if you take a marketing associate who's looking to shift careers and go into investment banking or plant management, that's a little more difficult sell, particularly at a school that's not top 20 and is not able to network and train you quite as well. Another factor, frankly, is a willingness to relocate, particularly Americans relocating overseas or internationals locating in America. That can be a good thing. It's going to provide higher number of offers, whereas provincial job seeking, as I call it, is going to limit earnings. Now, I'm in Pittsburgh, or I'm in Kansas City, or I'm in Washington State, and I have to stay there. Obviously, it's going to limit the number of offers, particularly from the mid-range schools. Another factor at the individual level, we have to be honest about this, minority persons who earn MBAs may benefit to a greater extent than non-minority persons at mid-range schools, and that's, again, a supply and demand phenomenon. Oftentimes, there are simply fewer minority persons graduating with MBAs than there are employers seeking minority MBAs because we like job place diversity, and that's a benefit to minority persons in general. Another qualitative factor is the concentration of the MBA. If we take a career in finance or investment banking or professional sales, those are relatively more risky, and they're going to pay relatively more, at least so long as you stay in field and do a good job, compared with, let's say, human resource management, which is a more general management field and less risky. So that's going to influence, particularly at these mid-range schools. And then you can't discount an individual's personality differences. A highly intelligent, highly motivated, ethically driven person is going to do better than somebody who's not as intelligent or ethically driven. So if you take a brilliant young person or not so young person that goes to a school that's not in the top 50, they can often rise to the top just on the basis of their gifts. I've seen that over the last 15, 20 years. It's hard to keep really, really bright people down, thankfully. And finally, good fortune can affect these earnings, being at the right place at the right time, both in terms of landing a job and launching new products and so forth.
In the final analysis, the professors say an MBA is a safe bet.
I think an MBA is a good risk. Go for the best MBA you can. There is nothing wrong with an MBA that hasn't made the top 50. But if you can get into a top 50 school, you should go. And if you can get into a top 20 school, even if you have to borrow, go to the top 20 school would be my advice.
So the clear story all the way through is invest in education.
Stay tuned to listen to an interview with Veritas Prep, a GMAT preparatory provider. You'll hear their recommendations for acing the GMAT. Veritas is also offering a special $150 discount on their test prep services to MBA podcaster listeners by using the code POD150 when registering for classes. This show was co-produced by Brad Pomerantz. For more information, advice, and to register for your weekly MBA podcast, visit MBAPodcaster.com. I'm Janet Nakano, and this is MBA Podcaster. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned next time when we discuss business ethics in MBA programs. I'm Janet Nakano from MBA Podcaster, and today we're giving you a look at the GMAT through the eyes of one of the leading GMAT preparatory programs, Veritas Prep. Veritas offers GMAT courses in more than 60 cities around the world. It offers 42 hours of class time. Its instructors have all scored in the 99th percentile, and close to a third of alumni score 700 or better. If you want to apply to business school, the GMAT is likely a necessary step. And if you want to go to a top MBA program, you'll be competing with those with high scores. Veritas Prep instructors deconstruct the GMAT by question types and key concepts and teach specific strategies that they say can boost scores by 120 points on average. We'll hear from Veritas Prep founder Chad Troutwine. We'll also visit a Veritas class where we'll meet an instructor and hear from a current student. An alumnus will share how much he benefited from the course, and you'll even walk away with several GMAT tips that can possibly increase your score. Be sure to stay tuned to hear about an exclusive discount that Veritas Prep is offering to MBA Podcaster listeners.
The seminar is designed as a way to sort of expose to you what you will face when you actually take the GMAT, let you know a little bit about the Veritas course, and to help give you a more informed decision about when you want to take the test, what kind of test prep options are going to fit for you.
Chad Troutwine is co-founder of Veritas Prep. He's leading a GMAT seminar at their Los Angeles classroom location.
The free seminar is not necessarily designed to have you leave a better test taker. However, we're going to spend about 10 minutes. And if you focus hard in that 10 minutes, you really master it, your test score will likely go up about 20 points before you leave. So it's kind of a nice little bonus. Just a little something for you. You're nice enough to come out here. We're just going to give you the 20 points on the extra 20 points in the GMAT. You know, and it can really make a difference. Maybe you can squeeze out 30. The difference in 30 points can be dramatic. The average GMAT score at Harvard last year was a 707. The average GMAT score at, no one went to the University of Florida, right? Good school. You know, look at what they're doing in athletics. Crazy. National championships in football and basketball in the same season. But, you know, if you're thinking, but it's still probably not a top MBA program, you'd be right. It's ranked about 45th in the country. Well, their average GMAT score is still a 675.
Troutwine himself scored extraordinarily well on the GMAT. He has a JD as well as an MBA from Yale. And it was soon after graduating from Yale that he and a classmate decided to launch Veritas Prep. Here at today's seminar, Troutwine explains to a group of MBA hopefuls how the GMAT works.
The GMAT used to work like most standardized exams, and that is every student that takes the test at a similar time faces the exact same questions. And you are graded based on how many questions you score relative to how the other people do on the test. Those raw scores are then converted into percentiles. Those percentiles are then uniform. So you have a rough gauge to compare someone who took a standardized exam in 1985 versus someone who took it last year. The GMAT is a little different. It's adaptive, meaning if we all went in and took the test the exact same moment in different cities across the country, we would all have different questions that we would face. So different, in fact, it would be unlikely that any one of us would even share a similar question. Their pool of questions numbers more than several thousand, both quant and verbal, all range by difficulty and the length of time each question on average requires for a student to solve. And so what happens is we roll in. And so the computer, the algorithm, I'm now going to kind of make it like it's a person. The computer thinks that you're all going to get right around a 537. It treats all of us the same. We roll in, and it's just assuming you're going to be like everybody else and kind of be right in the middle. Your answers then influence the computer's opinion of how you're going to do, and the test changes accordingly. It's really kind of fascinating. So if I roll in and I get five consecutive correct answer choices, now the computer thinks, I've got someone who's going to do well in the test. Let's see how well he will do. And it will then start submitting increasingly more difficult questions until I miss one. So it punishes me, but rewards me by giving me a higher score. So, and on the chart, that would match up to the sort of top bar. So we start all like right around 500, as I said, 537. So I get one correct. Say I get a few correct. The test will give me increasingly more difficult questions, but my score goes up. If I keep getting them right, my score can climb all the way up to an 800. But I have to keep getting them right, and the questions are going to continue to be very difficult. Conversely, if I go in there and I have a sluggish start, and I start missing a few, well, the test kind of feels sorry for me and starts lobbing in softballs. Come on, buddy. You can do it. And they just get increasingly easy. But my score drops accordingly, as it should. I'm not getting any questions right. By the end of the 37 quant questions and the end of the 41 verbal questions, the Graduate Management Admissions Council believes their algorithm has sort of locked in on your ability. And you're then given a score, a raw score first based on the number of questions and the difficulty level of those questions and the percentile relative to the other test takers. Okay, and that's your GMAT score.
Your GMAT score is just one piece of a whole puzzle, says Troutwine, but it's an important piece, especially if you want to be competitive for the top programs. The GMAT is similar to other standardized exams like the SAT and GRE, and he says it's pretty straightforward.
You start with an interactive tutorial that no Veritas student would sit through because you will have already done many, many practice GMAT exams and you certainly understand how to work through it. It's very simple. If you've been on a computer and you've sort of worked through any application, it's simple point and click with a mouse. It's very intuitive and straightforward. The first portion of the test is the analytical writing assessment. It is a scored set of essays. That portion of the test is scored on a pretty simple format. From 6.0, that's the best score, all the way down to 0. 2.0s and 1.0s, that would be like just above functional illiteracy. What happens is when you take the AWA, you want to make sure that your score is high enough not to arouse any suspicion that you would struggle writing an exam. It's not an area where you really gain strength or improve your candidacy during the application process, but it is a place where you could undermine your candidacy if you woefully underperform. If you get a really high score, that's great. And what's nice is with Veritas, you will. We have a foolproof template that creates a support matrix and set of tools that you'll be able to master in class and roll in knowing that you'll have a way to attack the AWA and get a high score. For those of you that already have evidence that you can write under pressure, either based on your major or your work, you have no fears. Now let's get to the more important scored portions of the test. You have an optional 10-minute break. If you choose to take that optional break, the clock starts, and it's an actual clock that ticks, and so, or it counts down in the computer. So if you go to the restroom or take your break, if you come back 11, 12 minutes later, you'll be 2 minutes into the scored section. So you want to be careful about that. The quantitative portion of the test is always 37 questions. It is always 75 minutes. You will always face 22 problem-solving questions, and you will always face 15 data sufficiency questions. You have another optional break, which is sometimes a good way to sort of refresh yourself and get focused on your next task, which is the verbal portion of the test. Again, it is always it's standardized. It's always 41 questions, and again, the length is always 75 minutes.
One of the things. Listeners, you can receive a $150 discount on any Veritas GMAT course, private tutoring, or MBA admission school package by registering at Veritas Prep with the code POD150. That's POD150. Learn more at veritasprep.com. Rob Howell recently took the GMAT after completing the 7-week-long Veritas course. He's currently working in a rotational program at Boeing, and he says he's planning on applying to business school next year.
I'm originally from Oklahoma. I went to school in Malibu, California at Pepperdine University. It's a little bit of a change of scenery. Studied international business. My very first GMAT that I took was just a practice test, and I scored a 580. Wasn't particularly happy with that score, especially considering my goals and my past performance, so I knew I had to do something. I did quite a bit of research on the different programs offered. Having taken the LSAT while I was still in school, I know how important it is to have, more than anything, it's the teacher. And I think a lot of people that I talk to could agree with that and can attest to that, because if you have a boring instructor or somebody that you just can't connect with, it can really be disastrous. The reason why now I'm such a believer in Veritas is because of the instructor. My first day, I show up and find out this guy aced his GMAT, has a master's degree in education, and just has tons of energy, and it's contagious. So I slowly improved my score, peaked around 700, and when I actually took my GMAT, I got a 680. I guess the most realistic schools that I'd really like to apply to and plan to apply to are the Anderson School at UCLA and SOM at Yale.
That weekend course, the last 2 weekends in July, you're more than welcome to come into that. So
it's 7 o'clock on a Thursday, and alumnus Rob Howell's instructor is teaching tonight. Brian Galvin has been a Veritas instructor since 2003. He is, as Rob said, full of energy. And tonight is the final day of class.
Talked a couple times about running marathons. I think the GMAT's a lot like that. The night before you run a marathon, you start thinking about, I wish I would have been able to do one more 20-miler. I wish I would have gotten a couple more speed workouts in. I wish I would have had an extra week to taper. I might be a little bit tired. But it doesn't matter, because that alarm clock's going off the next day and you have to run, so you know you have to make the best of it. Same thing with the GMAT. I think if you asked anyone who was serious about running a marathon, when's the optimal date to do it, they'd all think about, well, if I pushed it off 6 weeks, I'd get a little more training in, and then a weekend trip would come up in the middle of it, and they'd push it off and eventually be in worse shape for adding 6 weeks on. Same thing with the GMAT. If you push it off too far, you've gone through 7 weeks of regimented training for now. If you know you want one more refresher, maybe sign up for August, but should start thinking about putting a date together now so that you're accountable to it. So. First time I ever taught the class, my second lesson that I taught was arithmetic, and it was in Detroit, and it was a room full of automotive engineers. I was the youngest guy in the room, and I needed to teach them addition, subtraction, fractions, and was actually pretty intimidated by it, but found that a lot of people just need to relearn those rules, those technicalities, and even some of those skills that we take for granted when we move on to other things. And so our course is designed that we build from basic skills. Don't assume that anyone knows anything, you know, at least not everything they need to know about the test, or don't assume that everyone knows every skill. And by going through all those step by step, we give everyone a week to do homework, come back and discuss it at the beginning of the next class. We'll do our verbal lessons the first day each week, the quant lessons the second day each week, and that way they can come back, build on those skills, and then we can move on to more advanced things. Find that that's helpful for a lot of people just to get regimented to study again. People that have been out of school for 5, 10, even more years, just the being in a classroom and taking notes, I think takes a little time to get acclimated to finding a study rhythm. And so therefore, when they start to hit their stride and pick up those basic skills by the second, third week, we're really ready to take off and hit some difficult applications, and people tend to be comfortable moving on to the next step.
Like all Veritas instructors, Galvin scored in the 99th percentile of the GMAT. He took the test straight out of college, but decided not to get an MBA and instead focus on teaching. He appears to be one of those rare breeds gifted in standardized testing.
Brian's awesome. Brian's like, he's a Jedi master, basically, of the GMAT.
That's current student Ken Kasakian.
He breaks it down. I mean, just try Brian. Throw a question at him and see. Yeah, he's awesome. Veritas was the only one that was like a scientific, analytical machine in breaking down, like, what's going to be asked. And so that was obviously the better choice in that regard. They really are invested in why you're going to business school and helping you basically ultimately get there. So it's not just kind of, you know, the run of the mill, like, take our course and then, you know, we'll guarantee you a certain point increase. They teach from the perspective of where you're going to be and why you're involved in this arduous and, you know, traumatic process of studying for the GMAT.
Just a great example of sort of that overall GMAT concept of making the math as simple as you can make it.
Back in class, Brian Galvin is reminding his students that extensive calculations are rarely required on the exam. Like in this problem, asking to multiply a series of decimals.
If you've started multiplying decimals, you're on a long road toward frustration and eventual burnout. What's the best way to attack this one? Use fractions whenever possible. Division problems should be fractions. Decimals, whenever you can, convert them to fractions. Any of these seem easy enough to convert right away? So 0.333 is 1/3. 0.1667 is 1/6. And remember, we don't need to memorize all of these. Hopefully you have, but if you don't, if you see 0.1667, you know that it's a decimal. They don't want you multiplying four digits. And so you know that it can be converted to a fraction. Take a look. It looks like it's about half of 0.3333. If you do a quick mental math, it is. And so it's half of a third, which makes it a sixth. This one is 1/8. This one is 2/3. I think on the quantitative side, having gone through the quantitative review lesson tonight, the biggest key for students to keep in mind is that there's a finite amount of material that's testable on the GMAT. You won't be tested on things that are obscure or intensive calculations, anything like that. The biggest key to success on the GMAT is understanding exactly what you're responsible for knowing, the things we go through in our course, and then being able to find those testable concepts in any type of question that seems to be obscure or overtly difficult. A lot of times with students, particularly with geometry questions, if you can't find a circle, triangle, or basic quadrilateral, if that's not the shape being tested, there will be one of those in there if you draw a diagonal through a shape or take the area of that shape or anything like that. And for most people, being able to see the concepts that they know, even when a question might seem difficult, that's where you need to get started. And the GMAT tries to obscure those key concepts in a number of ways, but those concepts will always be what's being tested. So you don't want to fall into the distractions of a shape that looks awkward or a question that seems worded in a convoluted way. If you look exactly for the skill that you know you've worked through and the concept that you know is testable, begin with that and you'll find that the rest is just distractions to keep you away from the matter at hand. On the verbal side, the idea of key concepts, I think, is just as important as it is on the quantitative side, and sometimes overlooked by people. I think one type of question that students tend to overlook the difficulty with or do in the way that just feels natural is reading comprehension passages. The GMAT wants to give difficult material and write it in a way in which they sort of obscure what's really being tested. And a lot of students who are successful in other walks of life are successful because of their attention to detail. On the GMAT, you want to pay attention to detail, but only the detail you're responsible for. And a lot of people will find that it's helpful to anchor themselves not by technical terminology or anything that's not testable, but by transition language. And if you can find words such as however, conversely, or moreover and furthermore, then you know how their argument's being constructed, and you'll be able to look for the first part of the argument flowing into the second or the first part transitioning into a rebuttal. And a lot of people make the mistake of getting caught up in the subject matter when really more often than not, it's the structure of the passage and not the content of the passage that's really important to be able to answer the questions that follow.
Oddly, I think it's a calendar month, which doesn't seem to make sense, but there's some limitations.
Back at the GMAT seminar, Chad Troutwine is explaining how Veritas deconstructs the GMAT.
One of the things that we try and do is help you think like the test maker. We talked about sort of the job of the GMAT. It's to understand your analytical abilities, get a sense of your ability to work with math. And all that matters. I mean, business school is pretty difficult. At the top schools, it's really difficult. And it's very quantitative. You're not already gone through law school. And psychologically, I think law school is more grim than business school. But make no mistake, at the top business schools, it's very competitive. And they don't want to bring anyone in who can't handle the work. So the GMAT, even though it's annoying and it's flawed, and it's only a measure of one very narrow thing, it's not a bad test as far as standardized exams go. And then we also try and show you how the GMAT or the makers of the GMAT will design trapdoors. They will try and get you to do the wrong thing. We show you how they elicit wrong answers, in other words. Let's sort of get on the other side of the desk for a minute. They want to try and sort of distinguish a big group of people. So we can look at your grades, we can look at your previous work experience. Let's look at this analytical ability. If everything were very straightforward, scores would be inflated and would be harder to distinguish between people. So what they do is they try and create traps, sort of tricks to get you to fall through a trap door, and that can be done in a variety of different ways. One of the reasons why I've done so well on standardized exams, I'll just tell you, I probably have a pretty decent IQ, but I know there are people with higher IQs that don't test as well as I do. One of my strengths is maybe that sort of ability to sort of see the traps as they're set and know how to avoid them. One of the other things is I've always been able to work quickly without sacrificing accuracy. And that's one of the things we try and instill in our students. The ability to work accurately and still work quickly. And that's something that all of you will wrestle with. It's one of the reasons why we have 15 available practice tests. Give you the chance to sort of work on speed and timing and that kind of thing, more than anybody else in the industry. Again, I mentioned earlier that we offer more hours of instruction than our competitors. We offer more lesson booklets and more practice problems. What's great is you don't have to do all of that work, guys. This is not a college class. The only grade you get is the GMAT, and that's all on you. So if you want to just occasionally show up for class, that's fine. If you want to go to class and do that diligently, but not spend much time doing the homework, that's okay too. Although I can say one thing. There is a strong correlation to score increases in the amount of homework and number of practice tests our students do. Now, that score increase, not total score. Some people are just really good natural standardized exam test takers. And if you've already done well on standardized exams in the past, you're probably going to do well on this one. The encouraging thing is we work with people all the time that have struggled with these kinds of exams in the past, but they've mastered our techniques, diligently taken on the homework, diligently attacked the practice tests, and they get these big score increases. That's really fun and rewarding. Help is always nearby. We have more support than any other company. We offer not only email support, which I think all the bigger test prep companies offer. We also have a support line where you can call in and talk with an instructor live on the phone if you have homework questions. So that's nice and unique. We also, as I mentioned, we have the finest instructors. We say sort of, this is 99th percentile and beyond. And again, it's a reminder that it's not enough to simply score in the 99th percentile to teach for us. We only offer jobs to about one out of every eight otherwise qualified instructor candidate. Our basic full course, that's the one that meets two evenings a week for 7 weeks here in Los Angeles. It's the one most people take. It's our sort of standard flagship course. It's $1,500. We also offer a Saturday-only course. It meets for 6 hours on a Saturday for seven consecutive Saturdays. It's got a little break in between. It's not ideal. You know, 6 hours in a single day can get to be a little bit much, but for some people, they simply can't do the 7 to 10 format of our regular class. We also offer a weekend course. It's a little condensed. It's 36 hours, still much longer than the course length of any of our competitors. It's also a little less expensive. It's a verbal weekend, so you go all day Saturday and Sunday on verbal topics. The next weekend, you go all day Saturday and Sunday on quantitative topics. You can also split it up. So if you only want to focus on one or the other, if you already feel like you're going to get all the math questions right and you only want to do verbal, 700, just do that weekend. We also offer private tutoring. It's more expensive, although I think if you shop us around, our private tutoring prices are middle to low. Our course price is a little bit more expensive than our competitors, although we offer a lot more. Our private tutoring, as high as that seems, is pretty standard. That's nice for someone who wants something customized. They really want to work shoulder to shoulder with their tutor to sort of have that person analyze their deficiencies, their weaknesses. Maybe they have a bad strategic approach. Or maybe they just want that customized approach for whatever reason. They prefer that kind of learning environment than to a classroom.
That was Chad Troutwine, co-founder of Veritas Prep. If you're interested in their GMAT courses and want more information, you can visit veritasprep.com. MBA podcaster listeners can receive a $150 discount on any Veritas GMAT course, private tutoring, or MBA admission school package by registering at veritasprep.com with the code POD150. I'm Janet Nakano for MBA Podcaster. Thanks for joining us.